From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. There are a lot of ways to measure racial equality in this country. Money is just part of the picture, and the message is mixed. Over the past three decades, both black and white families have increased their incomes, but the income gap between white and black families has barely narrowed. For more, we've got author and economist Julianne Malveaux. She's the president of Bennett College. Welcome.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
I'm doing great. And so we're talking about this study released by the Economic Mobility Project. They talk about a generational drop in income. What exactly does that mean? What are they studying?
They're looking at parents and children, and over time, it's a longitudinal study that they did, which means they were able to look over time to see that people's incomes are moving in certain levels. And what they found is that while white people's children do better than those people did by and large, for African American people, it's less likely that the children will do better. Indeed, what you see is that more white children do better than their parents, while more black children are beginning to do worse than their parents. And that's a startling statistic.
That is. That flies in the face of this whole idea of the aspirational American dream. Why do you think such different records for people of different races?
Well, right. If you look at the times now and you look at the times, let's say 20 or 30 years ago, I think of myself and my own college experience, for example. I graduated from undergraduate school with $2,000 worth of student loans. The average student today graduates with $20,000. The average HBCU grad, $28,000. The average black student overall, $26,000. Those are staggering numbers. Some young African Americans are making a rational or perhaps irrational decision that they don't want to go to college because it costs too much. A generation ago, the government was more heavily invested in higher education. It's much less so now, which means that the students who are protected are the students who are either very bright and get full scholarships or who have parents of means. And that's less true for African American students. So we know that someone who goes to college earns in the course of their lifetime about $1 million more than someone who does not. So just think about that, and when you ponder on that and then look at this statistical pattern, you can partly explain some of that. The demise of affirmative action, affirmative action still exists on paper, but how well is it implemented, if at all? We've seen a backlash in the past two decades for affirmative action, but that was a door that was open for so many African Americans in the past and hasn't been as much these days. So that, again, would explain some of this erosion.
Julianne, let me ask a fundamental question here. When we talk about middle class, which is something that is part of this whole American dream, are there any differences in how we define it for a black family or a white family? What exactly is middle class anyway?
Well, that's a question, Farai, that you could have people debating on for a very long time. When you look at numbers, you want to look at, usually if you look at a statistical median for Americans, you'd be looking at something like $50,000. The statistical median for African-American families, though, is $30,000. So if you're only looking at median, that doesn't do it. If you roll back in our history and look at middle class, we used to say that there were black people who had working class incomes but middle class values, because if you recall the segregationist history, not recall it as if you were there, but recall it, you know that African American teachers, for example, were paid less in the South than white teachers were. In some states, as much as 40% less. So lower salaries, but still, as you say, aspirational visions for their children. And the notion was always that children should do better than their parents. So I'm going to duck that question to put precision around that which is middle class, but just share with you and with our listeners that the statistical median is an inadequate measure in the 21st century. It would change what middle class meant in terms of dollars.
Now, of course, when you have less money, certain fixed costs hit you harder. Right now, we're talking about gasoline, crude oil running at about $95 a barrel. It's about $2.40 per gallon at the pump on average, but it could go up. People are talking about the $4 figure. Is that realistic? Could that happen?
Certainly, if the oil prices continue to rise, you could look at a $4 gas price, and that would, as you say, hit the poor most. We did today, this morning actually, the spot price of oil went down by $1 a barrel. So that was an interesting thing to see, because OPEC has talked about perhaps expanding availability. But we know that we're vulnerable to supplies. We know that we're vulnerable to OPEC. And so we know that we really have not done our work. Again, I'd say since we had that first, those gas lines in the 70s, 73 or 74, since that time, we really haven't done what we should on energy policy because our politicians essentially have been wedded and welded to the energy industries as opposed to being welded to the good, you know, the well-being of our people.
Let me jump in on the federal level. The head of the Federal Reserve says these gas prices are dragging down the entire economy. Why would that be?
They absolutely are. You're looking at a time, we're going into the Christmas holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas holiday, but the last 6 weeks to 2 months of the year, we expect disproportionate spending on retail goods and services, and that disproportionate spending usually buoys our economy. You have people who are talking this Thanksgiving about not taking the trips that they were accustomed to taking because they're going to spend $60 to $80 every time they fill up their tank. So that is a drag on the economy. Oil prices, gasoline prices are so central to the way that we operate. You could talk about surcharges on various goods and services as things are transported across the country. So Ben Bernanke is right to make the point that this is something we've got to get under control. The challenge has always been, Farai, that we look at this every time we see gas prices. I think you and I have had a couple of these conversations in the past year or so. But every time these prices sort of flirt up towards $70, $90, $100 a barrel, everyone behaves as if they have to have some short-term solution. There is no quick fix to the energy issue in this country.
And, of course, we are entering heating oil time. So that's going to hit some people in another whole division of their spending.
And again, we expect, according to census, the average family spends about $1,000 a year, between $800 and $1,000 a year on Christmas, on holidays. But if those dollars are going to pay for heating oil, they won't be going for presents. And while that may not be the end of the world, Christmas should not be a commercial holiday. The fact is that retailers count on people coming to stores to spend money.
We have a couple of different stories that really play into this whole question of what's going to happen during the holidays. Stagehands on Broadway taking the picket lines. The protest is affecting 27 Broadway shows, including The Color Purple. Now, this whole strike could end up costing the industry $17 million a day. Is this something where, you see families coming from all over the country on buses to come and spend a special moment together? How significant is the economic impact of something like this, which occurs in one region of one city but seems to reach out to many other places?
I think it's hugely impactful. As you said, it's a $17 million a day price. But how many families will decide, I'm not going to come to New York if I can't see a show? A lot of folks are going, for example, to The Color Purple. I know of a couple of sorority groups who are doing buses up to The Color Purple. Well, that's not going to happen now, or at least if the strike is not resolved. So it really does affect tourism, and you know tourism is one of New York's most important industries. It affects tourism. It affects the dollars that are pumped in. I'd hate to be one of the restaurants that's around one of these Broadway shows. I mean, they basically depend, again, on people to come after the show or before to grab a bite, and that's going to cut down on their traffic. However, the flip side of it is that the stagehands really do believe that they have not been respected, and the fact is that the people who are the management has been saying things that are not exactly conducive to settling a strike. When they make comments about the unions being unfair to them, when they talk about the unions want you to believe they're the victims, when they say that people are not working and that they're lazy, that's not conducive to getting to an agreement. And so it seems to me that the climate for getting to agreement here is not there. Mayor Bloomberg offered to send in a mediator because this is important to New York City. But people don't seem to be, it's not even about meet me halfway. They seem to be on different continents.
Of course, the writer's strike continues as well. But I want to move on to another holiday topic. There has been a long line of recalls of products, toy products, that have originated in China. One of them now, the popular toy Aquadots. It was found to have a chemical that has been, it metabolizes in the body to GHB, which is known as one of the date rape drugs. This came as a huge surprise. Who should be held accountable? The companies who make the toys, the countries where the toys are produced?
really, it's the manufacturer. It's the company who makes the toys. Like, we can't get into a thing about this came from China. We've had recalls of toys over the years from all kind of countries. So I know that there's a sentiment right now as China's economy strengthens, we're very competitive with them. But the fact, and their labor costs, of course, are much lower than ours are, which makes it easy to manufacture things there. But whoever is selling these toys, I don't know this Aqua toy. Of course, we don't do toys, but whoever is selling it, whose name is on it, is it, you know, I hate to call a company because then I'll call the wrong one, but whatever company is manufacturing it, they're the ones who ought to be held responsible. You can't hold the manufacturer. We've got to be doing spot checks and all that. This seems like something that one could have found out fairly easily if we were doing the kind of inspection that we need to be doing. So whoever is bringing those toys to the United States and putting their label on them is liable, I think.
Congress is looking at having tougher measures and penalties. Do you think, it sounds as if you really are looking for more federal regulation?
I think so. I think that, first of all, well, there are two things. One, I'm looking for parents to be a lot more vigilant. But secondly, I am looking for more regulation. What are the penalties to doing this kind of thing? That's the issue. And if there are no penalties, people will do it because they can. This is a, you know, capitalist economy where people are trying to maximize profits and minimize their expenses. And inspection is an expense. The Consumer Product Safety Commission should be involved. But if these things, there should be a structure, and I know that Congress is looking at it. It's exciting. People should be fined. You know, they should be fined big time for this kind of thing, because unless they're disincentives, they're just not going to do it. Now, Farai, my free market friends are going to say, well, if you, you know, if you impose large fines, there'll be fewer toys on the market. But guess what? That would not be the end of the world.
All right, Julianne, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Author and economist Julianne Malveaux is president of Bennett College, and she joined me from member station WFDD in Greensboro, North Carolina. Just ahead, black military enrollment continues to fall, and a federal employee sports blackface to accompany Halloween party, coming up on our Bloggers Roundtable.